Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hey, this is Adam from Toronto, and I support Creative Control because Vish is full stop one of the best arts interviewers in Canada, or anywhere in the world, really. He approaches every episode like he's known the artist for years, creating a conversational atmosphere that gets straight to the heart of the work. No one else in podcasting gets it quite right like he does, with a mixture of meticulous research, wise artistic insights, and well-humored personal connections. I proudly support Vish and Creative Control on Patreon. You should, too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Jay Robbins is an influential multi-instrumentalist, singer, producer, and songwriter based just outside of Baltimore, Maryland. Originally from Washington, D.C., Robbins was one of many bass players in the hardcore band Government Issue in the mid to late 1980s, and he went on to lead a number of wonderful bands of his own, like Jawbox, Burning Airlines, and Office of Future Plans, among others. He also engineered or produced key albums by bands like The Promise Ring, Against Me, Farrakhet, Jawbreaker, and The Dismemberment Plan, among others, and he continues to run his own studio, called Magpie Cage. Robbins also makes music under his own name, including 2019's Unbecoming and its brilliant follow-up, Basilisk, which was released by Discord Records on February 2nd, 2024. Jay and I caught up recently for a nice talk about things like his life in Baltimore, how he made a band record during the onset of a pandemic, band resurrections and nostalgia, blending punk and synthesized sounds on Basilisk, isolation and connection, January 6th, ahistoricism and temporality, a Jawbox update, touring this new album, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this donor-driven podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol. That's the best way to support me and this work I do in a financial sense. So thank you for heading to Patreon and doing that. If you're able to, it means a lot. With additional support from Blackbird Music, a wonderful independent record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and a great website where you can order stuff shipped right to your house, potentially. The website is blackbird.ca. And say you want to order a copy of Basilisk by Jay Robbins, head over there or your you know, if you can go to your local record store, that's great. But if you want to support another independent record store, there you go, Blackbird. So go to blackbird.ca today and see what you can get. Plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 835 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Jay Robbins, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Jay. How's it going?
It's going pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm well. It's nice to have you on the show. It's nice to talk to you. I mean, I've been a fan for a long, long time. Where in the world are you?
I'm in Pikesville, Maryland, just outside of Baltimore, in my house, in my upstairs music room.
Oh, nice. This is your studio?
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I have a proper big studio down in the city with a big live room and lots of mics and stuff, but I converted our upstairs bedroom into a demo room initially, sort of a, you know, kind of music jam room, but now it's turned into, I do a lot of mixing in here now too. So.
I see. Cool. Yeah. That's great that you can do that from home. Everybody's working, doing something at home now. It's, I wonder sometimes how the people we live with, our roommates, our families, how they feel about all this stuff we do from home. Do you get any feedback about the racket you make?
I mean, it's generally, you know, I mean, my wife Janet and I have been married for going on 24 years, so there's a lot of mutual understanding at this point. But I mean, every now and then, if I'm working on something that sort of strikes her the wrong way, she'll make an observation. Let's put it that way.
Oh, I see. It's not necessarily keep it down in there. It's, I didn't like that part. That time signature is not working. That's what you get?
Well, no. No, I mean, I'm not talking about stuff that I work that I'm not talking about music of mine. I'm talking about things that I work on, you know, other people's stuff. I see. Because I can grow to love just about anything if I'm engaged with it. But Janet doesn't have to do that.
So she has more objectivity about the projects that you're referring to, the production work you do.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
OK, cool. And sorry, how long have you been there in Maryland?
Well, I grew up just outside of D.C., but we moved to Baltimore in 2002. Hmm. So, long time.
And just for people wondering, how far away? That's not that far, Baltimore from D.C., right?
It's not. It's sometimes it feels like worlds apart, you know, but really it's only about 35 miles.
Oh, okay.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
So, just kind of trying to find, not a suburban life, but like people would probably not like it if they live in Baltimore, if it was known as a suburb of DC. It's not.
People would definitely not like that. Baltimoreans would definitely not be psyched to be thought of in that way.
Right.
It's definitely its own city and it's its own world, really, Baltimore.
Yeah. Yeah. I think most of us or a lot of us know a lot about it from that show, The Wire.
Which is not an inaccurate impression.
Oh, really?
It's pretty accurate in a way.
Okay.
It's accurate about many aspects of life in Baltimore, I would say.
Well, then it sounds very exciting.
Remember the graffiti at the beginning of The Wire that says Bodymore Murderland?
Yes.
When it's in the credits, right? That was right around the corner from my studio.
Oh, okay.
I drove past that every day.
And so how do you feel living in a place with graffiti like that?
I mean, I love Baltimore. I've always loved it since long before I moved here. So it's, you know, I mean, anywhere can be Bodymore Murderland.
I assume it's just you need a city with a good murder pun, like a name.
That's the best.
Yeah, that's probably
try and
the
top
best.
That.
That's the best one. Do you have a little musical community there? I know some people who live in Baltimore, I think. You know some people?
Yeah, I mean there's a lot of great stuff happening in Baltimore. And there's a lot of I think this might be true everywhere, right? There's a lot of kind of micro scenes that kind of overlap and coalesce, and they sort of add up to one big scene, but they don't necessarily, yeah, you know, it's all very kind of elastic. Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of creativity here, and there always has been, because it's still one of the cheapest places to live on the East Coast. So it's like you can, and this is the thing I always loved about it, like you can really live here and kind of grow your own garden, and there's a lot of wonderful weirdness that doesn't try to escape out into the world, because that's not what it's about. It's just about cultivating your thing, and then if people need it, they'll find it, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean it's every few years you get these kind of waves where, you know, real estate developers and speculators and people with ambition, they kind of realize that Baltimore is here, and they go, oh, the untapped potential. And they try and push a wave of development and get Baltimore to join the East Coast, and property prices go
yes,
up and
yeah.
things get scary. And there's a whole lot of rumors of gentrification. And thus far, it only ever reaches a kind of it only ever goes so far before it all comes crashing down,
yeah.
because Baltimore just has that ne'er-do-well energy that sort of, you know. The grand plans tend to get frustrated, but so all the cool subterranean things can go on happening in some form, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it sounds cool. I've been there briefly, but it sounds like there's a lot to do. It sounds very immersive. I know as a creative people, your surroundings, the place you live in, can inform the work you do either subconsciously, consciously. Are there instances in your catalog, the new album or others, where you feel like Baltimore has played a specific role, less of a subconscious thing, but maybe something you wanted to address?
Well, I mean, Abandoned Mansions, the second song on my previous record, is directly about Baltimore. I mean, it was inspired by a house that fell down. It's inspired by a lot of things in Baltimore, but there was a particular, right down the street from my studio, there was a row of row houses that was mostly abandoned. And you get this a lot here, where you get a row of row houses and they're all empty and they're falling apart. And then the second one from the end, there's a family living in it, you know?
Huh. Yeah.
And so there were a couple blocks like that right near the studio. And I remember being in the studio one day and hearing this kind of ominous, you know, just kind of wrong sounding rumble coming from outside. And I was like, holy shit, what's that? And I ran out front, and the middle house in this row had just chosen that moment to just collapse into the street in a pile of rubble.
Wow.
And yeah, but I mean, there's a lot of really grand, in the neighborhood where we used to live down in the city, there's a lot of really grand kind of big brownstones and really big. There's this one giant Victorian building that used to be a brewery, and we used to always see it out of our window. And we went up there one day and just to get a closer look at it. And, you know, it was just completely falling apart. And, you know, the way back home was kind of right through an open air drug market. And so that song Abandoned Mansions was just, it was just trying to be a little capsule snapshot of like a Baltimore moment, you know, kind of drive. And the studio is also right next to the city, really close to the jail, the main jail, which is a fascinating building because it's old. It's got to be from the 18th century. It's got to be from the 18th century. Might be from the 19th century, but it's a giant old, it almost looks like a castle with big stone edifice. So that song, I was particularly trying to get a lot of Baltimore into it. And the bridge actually has a quote from Edgar Allan Poe, because, and I can't remember what poem it's from, but oh yeah. It's about, from a tower in the town, death looks gigantically down. it's a cheery little tune.
I guess it makes sense that if someone asks you about your city, our default would be to talk a little bit about its architecture. It's interesting that you chose two examples of that, the jail and the, you know, houses falling apart. But that is a city. So I think it's what I'm getting at is it's probably fairly normal that that's what you homed in on.
Right. Building. No, sure. Right. It's, yeah, it's like taking snapshots. I mean, I think another thing that is funny about this town is I think if you come to it, I mean, this used to happen to me all the time, actually, because I went to Maryland Institute College of Art, which is in Baltimore, but I commuted from D.C. So I wasn't really experiencing the city. I was experiencing the school, but I was driving in and then driving out. And if you're not here, I mean, Baltimore really buries its treasure. Like you have to go looking. And if you don't go looking, you could just be like, eh.
Yeah.
Whatever, you know? So
you have to know the city, you mean? Like you have to know what to look for?
Yeah. Right. You have to like connect with people and sort of really be proactive about finding the cool stuff.
Yeah.
Because, which is true everywhere, right? But especially true, I think, in Baltimore, it's just, you know, there's so much awesome stuff going on, but you gotta dig a little bit.
Yeah.
So
no, it's cool. And I'm glad that you're happy there and you got a studio and you got a house. That's cool. I want to commend you on this brand new album of yours. And I hope I'm saying this right. Basilisk. Is the thing. And I don't know that I heard a lot of Baltimore in it, or maybe I'll re-listen to it after this conversation and and with a magnifying glass and try to figure this out. But it's a really riveting and infectious sort of album. So congrats on it. Like, it's really super charged up. I needed this album because I just haven't heard.
Wow.
You're older than me, but that was my first foray into making music, is like this sort of sound, the what I would describe as kind of post-hardcore infused, but catchy, you know, like there's like a pop sensibility. And I just haven't heard it that much lately. And this is really, yeah, I just want to say I love your album.
I appreciate that so much. Thank you.
Yeah, congratulations.
That makes me so happy.
Yeah.
I was like really, really, I'm so pleased to hear that. That's wonderful.
Well, and you're probably, as you can tell, I'm an older fella. So you're probably going to hear from people of my vintage, 40s, 50s, whatever it is. Again, I think you're older than me. Is this a sound you miss? Is this a sound that you don't hear that much, do you think, in the world? I can't tell. I maybe feel unplugged from this realm. But like for me, it was like, oh, yeah, it's brand new and fresh. But it reminds me of the things I love, the drumming, I'm a drummer. So like my ear and the drumming is just fantastic. And it reminds me of certain things. But I don't mean to be nostalgic about it. Can you objectively kind of see your record as sort of standing out in this current landscape of music making?
I have no concept of it, of a context for it, honestly. I really don't, because I just think, I mean, I think I know what you're saying, but I don't, I've never responded that well to sort of the... A lot of people are just dying to categorize things, and they need to sort of put them in their buckets, you know.
Yep.
And I think about this periodically, especially like you said, as getting older, right? I'm 56.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, I've seen sort of waves of these kind of genre conceptions kind of come and go and mutate, and people sort of, you know, a generation comes up and they might latch on to certain things that were happening just before they were starting to do things, and they'll sort of, people categorize them and spin them differently because they're kind of living their moment or whatever. But I mean, so for me, for better or worse, it's been one long moment, you know, since I was going to say since I auditioned to play bass in Government Issue in 1985. But actually, even before that, if I think about music and creativity and expression and finding a sense of community and, you know, the kind of things that you kind of art and music that you find that it connects with you and kind of gives you that charge, that's just a continuum.
Yeah, it's a trajectory, right? You've been on. Yeah, I see.
Yeah. So I think of it like I'm much more, if it comes to music that I'm actually making, I think of it much more in the context of what I've done before and sort of balancing the two things of like trying to get better at it and hone my craft in that sense, really pretentious, but like, you know, try to do it, always do it better. And then also try to not do the same thing that I just did, you know, try to expand my palate and be open to, because I am a pretty open-minded listener, and creatively, there's a lot of things, there's a lot of like things texturally and harmonically and, you know, like there's a lot of places I want to go. Like I'm excited for things that I can't imagine yet. You know what I mean? I want to get to the place where I can imagine them. So I think of it as a, whether it's a straight line or, you know, this sort of ever revolving thing. And I don't really get bogged down too much in those kind of like waves that people are in. And I'm really aware of them, especially with recording. I'm aware of them because now I tend to be recording people who are often, you know, 20, 25 years younger than
right.
me.
Right. Yeah.
And their touchstones sometimes tend to be things that, like, for them, it's ground zero, but I can see that that ground zero was actually built on an influence from something else from a decade before, but that didn't come up in a vacuum either. So it's like, it's kind of cool, that constant snowballing conversation of how music evolves. That's really cool. But it is frustrating sometimes when people are like, oh, I love your 90s drum sound. And I'm like, I like to call that a drum sound. I don't really like to think of it as like, how can a drum sound be from a decade? I mean, of course it can. You have think of certain tropes and cliches or whatever.
Is it the sound or the approach? Like, that's a weird thing to say, a 90s drum sound on some level. But I think.
Well, right, I mean, this is as a recording engineer, you know.
Yes, like, yes, of course. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I appreciate the distinction between the sound of a recording and the approach to playing. I just want to clarify that from my point of view, when I invoke the drumming, it does remind me of that interesting moment in time, probably in the early, maybe throughout the 90s, actually, of like that real blend of whatever post-rock or post-hardcore was, which in my conception, I was listening to a lot of jazz records and going to a lot of punk shows and listening to a lot of punk music. And when I played, that's what happened. Like, that's what I tried to do. I tried to play with some measure of passion, but finesse. And all my peers were kind of doing that, like experimenting with what the kit even is. Maybe we'll just play you don't have to play the cymbal the whole time, play the rim, you know?
Right.
A classic thing for me, and I don't want to get too inside baseball about this for people who find this boring, but like when I was a kid, just discovering the hi-hat was just so fascinating that you could open and close it and create this like sound and emphasis. It seems like such a thing we all take for granted now, but the kids you're talking about, I don't know. You're absolutely right. Like, we discovered music however we discovered music, going to shows in probably alternative spaces or whatever they're called, and getting zines, and, you know, the internet was just starting. But yeah, certainly in the last 5-10 years, things like Riot Fest and whatever not are bringing bands back, bringing sounds back. And I had a theory that the internet demand was driving that a little bit. Like, what the hell? Why is our record suddenly doing really well on YouTube, or why is it selling all of a sudden? And then I think enough people in powerful positions were like, or bands themselves were just like, maybe we can do a tour. Like, I don't know what's going on, but maybe we should put the band back together. So it's not nostalgia. It is resurrection or something.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that, right. I think that's fair.
Yeah.
Absolutely fair.
Yeah. And I like it. I like that something about this sound. And I don't mean to say that this record, like, I think of a song like, is it pronounced Sonder?
Yeah.
That's a real anomaly on the record, I would say. Would you agree?
Yeah, that's the only song that was written on purpose for the record, actually.
Oh.
I think I had about 15 songs and I picked 10 that made a good, that I felt made a good flow, because they were basically like, they're sort of two sets of, and there's not really two sets of songs, but it's kind of like there's sort of two parallel tracks, and I'm, or like there's two train tracks, and I've got my foot on one train on one track, and my left foot's on one train and my right foot's on the other train, and the tracks are diverging, you know?
Yeah.
So there's a set of songs that is very much like live band in a room with minimal or no overdubs. And then there's a set of more abstract constructed songs that are more, you know, maybe electronic based. And I was trying to see if I could balance those two things. And when I picked the 10 that seemed to hang together the best, it didn't go far enough into the left field.
No.
And in the spot where I wanted it to go. And I thought, like, that doesn't say everything that I, the record doesn't say everything I wanted to say yet. And the kind of sounds that are happening in Sonder are a thing that I've been working on a lot up here in this room. And so I just thought, like, well, I want that in there to pull the record a little bit out of the realm of a little bit. So it's not so neatly in the rock.
Absolutely.
Bucket, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And that stands out from the very first song, which I think is a nice hybrid of the train tracks that you were talking about. It's called Automaticity. And that, am I right? Would you agree? Like, it has that blend of synthesis and supercharged kind of rock and impassioned vocal thing happening. Is that a fair assessment of that song?
Yeah, I think that wasn't so, that wasn't sort of, that's the first song that was written in this batch of songs that became this record.
Yeah.
And that was actually written somewhat under the influence of listening to Sparks.
Yeah.
Like a lot,
yeah.
a lot. Like I had a real like Sparks moment where that's just all I listened to for a couple months. And so maybe that shows. But so it wasn't, it's funny because it was sort of like, I didn't realize that it would be the, you know, like I never have a plan for anything really. I just sort of do a bunch of stuff and then see what it looks like it wants to be.
Yeah.
So that's funny to think of it that way, because in a way that have the record, that song coming first, sort of does say like, oh, I'm trying to infuse these two aesthetics a little
you
bit.
You didn't think of it that way as a kickoff song. Is it just occurring to you now?
I was just trying to write a good song.
You know, you mentioned Sparks. You mentioned Sparks, who I view as a really fascinatingly subversive pop band, and I feel like that is a gift you have too. Like in all the work that you've done, it might be coming from a gritty place, but you have this really solid pop sensibility, I think. Do you know where that emanates from exactly? As a music fan, as a music maker, this notion of making something that is both provocative and yet accessible, I suppose?
I don't. I mean, it's got to probably come from the same place that everybody, like, I think I just know what I, I mean, I could like sort of just make a list of things. Like I know when I was a real little kid, you know, in my house, we had Beatles records.
Yeah.
We had some Black Sabbath records. And then my parents listened to a whole lot of other music that I thought was really terrible, but I loved those records. And then I got a little bit older and turned into a like really super awkward kind of art nerd that couldn't really hang with most other kids. And I was obsessed with film, with particularly with just filmmaking and films and filmmaking. And I thought I was going to be a filmmaker, and I got really into film soundtracks. And that was all I listened to for years. But I would sit, and like, as ridiculous as this might sound, like I would, you know, be listening to like the Star Wars soundtrack with my headphones on and literally be like, why is this music hitting me so hard? You know, why is it? Cause it's just, you know, cause soundtrack music is just designed to get in and manipulate your emotions. And I'd be like, how is it doing this to me? How is it making me feel this way or that way? Why is my pulse racing from this, you know, why is this theme triumphant when it's stated here, but then in this other scene, it feels really tragic. And I'd be like, it made me start thinking about harmony, basically.
Yeah.
Harmony, rhythm and harmony. And I would sit at the piano and try to sort of figure out, you know, the counterpoint and be like, okay, well, I know there's a main theme, but there's this other voice that comes in and here it's going someplace that subverts everything.
Yeah.
And that's where I get really interested.
Yes.
Suddenly I'm gripped is when it feels a little wrong and the air gets really charged. So I was like studying that kind of on my own in my own weird way, but it wasn't ever going to go anywhere because I literally was just sitting in my parents' house playing piano with headphones on, you know, with a Walkman with like the soundtrack from Psycho or some shit. And like, so finding the punk rock scene was the thing that kind of woke me up to the idea that I could actually create some, you know, because I was literally thinking like, well, I'll never be a film composer because you've got to do this and you got to do that and you got to have all of these credentials and have all of this, you know, it's got to be official or whatever it was I thought. And then, you know, punk kind of saved my life by showing me that nothing had to be official and people were just making whacked out shit and all being involved with it. You know, that was a real moment. But in that moment, I know even the bands that I loved when I first heard them were like XTC, you know, where there's like super solid pop, like songcraft, but it's got a, you know, particularly like that early middle era, like Drums and Wires through like Big Express, like Black Seas, the first record of theirs that really grabbed me. And that record is just full of these pop gems, but they've got a kind of like bristly aspect.
It's so haunting. Like I'm still haunted by the first time I ever heard like Dear God or Making Plans for Nigel or something. You're just like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah.
And so I think we're coming from a similar place of like, I like it, but I also like that it's sort of disturbing or isn't necessarily all bright and happy.
Right. I mean, it's like it's beautiful, but there's beauty. There's real beauty and real emotion, but it's not trying to get you to like it. You know, that's the thing that I always am just like, when you hear a song that's just like, I just want you to like me. Like, that's the song that I just cannot fucking
tolerate.
Yeah,
we turn them off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something about how people like you and I are wired. We're like, I think you're trying too hard to get my attention and I have a good filter. And I'm going to just ignore it, which, sometimes I've tried to apply that to humans sometimes, and it's not a good thing. It's not good. It's not socially acceptable to it. You're supposed to be like, oh, yeah, that's good. Good job. And then move on with your day. Anyway, I want to talk about the making of this record because it's an interesting story, and it follows up on your previous solo record from, 2019 or something like that you put out?
Yeah.
No. Is that right?
Came out in May of 2019.
Right. A different time. Lots of difference. Yep. Can you tell us a little bit about the story of attempting to make Basilisk? Because it sounds like it was a bit of a saga from what I understand. But it's a fully realized band record. I was kind of listening to both records this week and I thought, yeah, I can see the evolution and what has changed from my perspective. But can you speak to those things? The distinction between the two and, like I say, the story behind making this album, the new one?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, God, thank you. I really like it. It's so weird. Like I don't know if it's a pandemic thing, you know, the fact of that lost year and a half or 2 years or whatever it was, or, I mean, it's a lot of factors, but this particular record, in one way, I've just been living with it in my head. And the fact that like you listen to it, and you have thoughts about it, it's just fucking blowing my mind right now.
Is this the first interview you've done about the record?
No. I mean, I did one the other day, and okay. I had a very similar feeling where I was just like, what? We're talking about Basilisk? Like, what?
Well, you make these records.
You listen
kind
to
of
it?
It's weird, right? You make a thing in secret, and then you've processed it all from all sorts of angles, and it gets mastered, and it's done. And then it can be months and months later before anyone revisits it with you, or years for some people. So, yeah, I understand why you're freaking out, but I'm just happy for you.
Thank you. Yeah. But like in every case, whenever I do something, this is true for anyone who's trying to create something, they want to do something better. You know, it's the next thing you do is always the best thing. It's always going to be the best thing you did, right? So I have had that in the forefront of my mind this whole time. And then, you know, I played it for some friends over the last few months who all said really nice things. And I was just like, well, you're just being nice. You're my friend, you know?
Yeah,
like,
sure.
Like you would say that, you know, but the difference I think between the two records process wise was the first record. I mean, in attitude wise, it was kind of that similar thing of just like, I'm not going to stop until it's the best I can do, you know, like, and that record took a long time to come together. And there was not all that much live band interaction. There was a lot of, working things out in a demo. There were a few songs that were tracked more or less live as a band, but the majority of that record was tracked, you know, different people tracked their parts at different times. And then a lot of editing went on after the fact for certain songs, especially in the back half of the record. Some of those songs were like recorded kind of before they were fully written, because someone was available on that day, and, you know, Pete, the drum, Moffitt, the drummer, had certain availability or whatever it was, you know, or I just had a wild, you know, need to do something to feel like the record was moving forward. But so it happened over a long time, and it was a real construction project. And though I'm quite happy with how it turned out, when you're creating something and it takes a long time, you go through these kind of peaks and troughs.
Yeah.
Where, oh, it's the best thing I've ever done. And then a week later, you're like, this is garbage, bullshit. I fucking hate myself. And then you come out of that thing again, right? So I went ups and downs again and again. And a lot of like, no, it shouldn't be that guitar sound. It should be this guitar sound. And that part should be a little different. And now I'm going to have to go back and retry. It's just like tedious. Mm. So I sort of, you know, which is fine. It also had a lot of great high points. And it was a wonderful experience to make that record. But at the end of it, I was like, the next thing I do, at least some of it has to have that feeling of like the band knows the songs and we just go in and record it all together. And what those songs are is the capture of a moment. And there's no going back wondering if this different guitar sound would be cooler or anything. It's just like you have a concept and you are really getting that moment and you execute and then it's done. And that's what I really, really wanted. And that was sort of when I was demoing songs, that was what I had in my mind. And then of course COVID hit and nobody could really do anything. Like I couldn't practice with any, I've been thinking about this a lot lately too. I listened a little bit to your conversation with Pete Stahl about Scream.
Oh yeah.
And about sneaking into the practice space kind of thing. And I mean, I remember when the lockdown was so mild here compared to some places, but
sure.
But at that moment, the like paranoia and uncertainty of it was like, you know, I brought my computer and my speakers home from the studio because I thought like, I'm not going to be allowed to go there. I shouldn't go there and I'll have to stay home and maybe people can send me things to mix. You know, I didn't know what was going to happen. So that, you know, the sort of beginning COVID times probably spurred me to do more electronic music, to do more of the stuff that's like Sonder. But I had these those other songs like Exquisite Corpse and Ray of Sunlight and Old Soul and, you know, the ones that are more Deception Island, the ones that are about half the record that's more like a rock band.
Yeah,
I had those songs kind of demoed. And after a while, I just thought like, there's no end in sight to this thing. Like I just, wouldn't it be great to just do something and have a studio? And I know, you know, Brooks, who's my dear friend, who's played with me for a long time, who played bass on the record, and Darren Zentek, the drummer who I've collaborated with for years, who's just a genius, you know, and a wonderful human. I just thought, well, like I just emailed them and I was like, look, if we test a lot for a couple of days,
yeah,
and we all are really sure that we're fine, what if we just went in the studio for 2 days and learned these songs as a band and just we'll hit record on the spot, you know? And it was so great. It was one of the greatest experiences, I almost want to say like of my life in a way, because it was such a relief to actually see my friends and be in the same room with them and everybody have this project where we're not worried about the fate of the world. You know, we can just focus on this creative thing.
The context of all of this matters, I think. The fact that you were in still the first couple of years of this pandemic and wondering, you said something, sorry to interrupt you, by the way, Jay, but you said something.
No, it's okay.
You said something there about how you didn't know what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And I think this is, that's related to time. What's going to happen is a future question.
Yeah.
And I think what you're articulating is that at the time that you made this record, you know, and worked on it, there was an urgency there that you didn't have in making Unbecoming. I think for a lot of us, our relationship to time pre and post the beginning of this pandemic has changed. And it feels like maybe in 2019, you were like, ah, I got all the time in the world. I'll fuss and I'll work on this to death. And it doesn't matter. I can take all the time I want. But I think something consciously has changed within all of us in terms of like, I don't think there's a lot of time.
Yeah,
so I'm going to approach what I do with a greater immediacy and urgency and be done with it so that I can get on with it, because it feels like my window of time to do things, and I don't mean this morbidly, I just mean it feels shorter. Like I don't I
No,
just,
100%.
Yeah, is that okay?
Yeah. I'm in total agreement about that. I mean, I think about it, it's a fact of getting older. This is a joke that I make routine, like almost every other day I say something like that, like, you know, look, you know, death is just over the horizon. Like, let's make up our minds and do the thing.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And which is really good, because I'm the sort of person who has tended to like work things over and worry, not just creatively, like in life, you know,
yeah.
I've been like, you know, sort of gnawing my knuckles going like, but is it the right thing at the right time? And maybe if we did this, it would be better, you know, just like, no, just fucking do something.
Yeah.
So the first session we did, I think we did like six or seven songs. I can't remember exactly, but it was so fun. And it was such a relief, you know, to do this thing that it's like we literally couldn't do with people, which is a thing, you know, with other people, you know, outside of our little pod.
Yeah.
Right. And the coolest thing about it was that it really felt like if you listen to the tracks, like you could. All that feeling was like actually in there, which is just something that I've always dreamed of that. That's like the, you know, that's what you want when you make a recording.
Chemistry, like the community minded chemistry of it all, like the communal aspect of
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, right. And just the feeling of like, of presence and excitement and yeah. Oh my God, it's happening. You know, like it really felt, at least to me, you know, this is obviously it's my perspective, it's subjective, but like I hear the tracks and I'm like, yeah, that was totally what it felt like. So it was very cool feeling, you know. So that's like half the record is that kind of thing. Yeah. And then the other half the record is sort of electronic. But and then there was a subsequent session because the other thing, it was the first bunch of songs that we got together, I had pretty clear ideas about the drums and bass. Which is sort of you know, it's for better or worse. Like I've always sort of needed to hear a whole song in my head when I'm writing. Like I need to kind of know some idea of how the pieces are going to fit and where it's going to go. But I've certainly been in bands like Jawbox is a band that was highly collaborative and no one person could dictate, you know, there's probably like after Zach Barocas joined on drums in Jawbox is probably like two songs that I could point to and say, well, that song sounds exactly like what I wrote in my head.
Right.
But a lot of the other times I would just bring songs and then we would have to adapt it to whatever he was going to play. Or a lot of the time he would have a rhythm and the song would build up from the rhythm first. So I thought when we came to do the second batch of band songs, I thought it would be a lot cooler to write without trying to have too much of a concept for the drums, at least. You know, so that Darren could, because Darren's so insanely creative, he's just like a poet on the drums, you know. So
yeah.
I feel like I wanted to give him a chance to not to just do. I'm like, if Darren comes up with something, it's going to be fucking awesome. I can't wait to see what he does,
yeah.
You know. And that was a cool challenge too, because it's very hard to write that way for me. But one of those songs that turned out really, really good isn't on the record. So, but like Last War is that way. Last War started as an completely electronic song that didn't have drums. It was like a all kind of software synths. And you would recognize it, but you'd be like, huh, imagine that, you know? And then I just thought like, what if I played this part on the guitar? What if that was the bass line? And then I was like, oh, cool. There's no drum part. Awesome. Darren can just like let his freak flag fly.
But it's an amazing performance, if I might say. That's one of my favorite songs in this record, and I'm glad you invoked it because we've been talking so much about the sound of the record that I haven't really asked you too many questions about maybe the lyrical intent. And I know, from what I can tell, that song reflects a pretty horrible point in American history. And I wonder if, in a general or overarching sense, you can talk about that. Well, that song in particular, since I brought it up, but maybe where your mind was at, where your head was at when you were pondering what to write about for this record, because even Exquisite Corpses, like, you got me Googling, Jay. I was like, what is that again? Like, what's Exquisite Corpses? And I look it up. I'm like, oh, it's like a word game or collaborative word game. And then I'm looking up.
It's a party game.
Party game.
It's
yeah.
Surrealist party game.
Surrealist party game. Yeah. That's what I looked up. I mean, I'm just going by my basic internet research, but you had me going and looking up stuff, which I like. I want to tell you, I value when someone says something like even Basilisk. We were talking before we started rolling where I looked it up. And I was like, what is, oh, it's like a lizard or something. And you clarified it's a mythical creature, right?
Yeah. It's a medieval monster whose gaze turns you to stone. I think its breath turns you to stone as well.
Yeah.
It's one of those, like a chimera or a, there's two of them. There's a basilisk and a cockatrice. And there's one of them has the head of a rooster and the body of a reptile. And the other one has the body of a rooster and the head of a dragon or something. But anyway, it's a real kind of Lewis Carroll sort of, thing.
Well, what I'm getting at is I like when a song or an album provokes me into doing some extra research. I enjoy that. And some of these songs did that. But again, sorry, I went on a ramble there. Do you have an overarching thought about where your mind was at as you conceived of the lyrics for this record?
I mean, I think, no, because it's 'cause I'm never very, I'm really in awe of writers who are, of anyone creative who has a clear intent. This was a thing in art school that used to really stymie me. And just in art in general, you know, like some people start out with a concept and they're very clear about how they're going to flesh it out. And, you know, if you're, whether you're talking about some conceptual artist or whether you're talking about like Stephen Sondheim, you know, like I have a book of Stephen Sondheim lyrics and I was like reading up on him, and that's somebody who knows what he's going to write about. And then he drills down on all the details and everything is consciously heading and accumulatively in the same direction. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just fucking completely in awe of that because I've never been able to, very rarely been able to do that. I don't know if I'm self-conscious of like I'm, more and more, this has been a project for me, like trying to write on specific topics and express things clearly to make that connection instead of sort of chopping up a word salad and then hoping that someone latches onto something. Because typically for me, like melodies always come first and then I start singing nonsense. And maybe if I'm lucky, I'll sing something that sounds enough like words that I can stick to it. And then I'll go, what could those words be about? And then things will sort of blossom, you know, sort of flesh out from there. Or I'll keep, like, I have a list in my phone of cool phrases that I run across. Or even sometimes, like, stupid as this is, a lot of times my most unguarded writing is like a Facebook post. And I'll look back at something that I wrote on Facebook and I was like, shit, I should just sing that. That's totally like, because it came out without any editorial thought. So all those things are sort of in the hopper as far as the process. But it's all response. It's all like emotional, like voodoo dolls. And we live in a fucked up, horrifying time. So I think that a lot of the response is like, you know, I mean, I could give you like little digest things like automaticity is a lot about getting older.
Well,
and not taking things for granted, you know?
Yeah.
Last War is definitely like, it's definitely a post January 6th type of song because I just can't believe that anybody is, I can't believe that you could pretend to still have a functioning government when half of the people who are participating in it want to destroy it. You know, like there's people like, and the other half are trying to just pretend that they can go back to business as usual.
Well, getting back to what I was saying about what I view as your interest in time. Again, I was talking about the urgency of with which you made this album. But what I pick up on here and there is someone in modern times trying to provide some historical context for what is becoming a very ahistorical time. If that makes any sense, like people are not behaving there's this weird confusion of like, make things the way they were,
right?
But also the way things were aren't what you think they are. That never happened. Like this manipulation of history to dictate the future and the present is really something that, and I know it's probably wasn't your intention, but I just pick up on that here and there on these songs of someone sort of negotiating what time means and what history means and how it should or shouldn't inform the present and the future among a populace that doesn't seem to trust time.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think about this all the time. I mean, particularly in light of the Trump thing, I'm like, I mean, I remember reading, it's a book, it's called Before the Deluge, and it's about the Weimar Republic, mm-hmm. you know, the brief socialist democracy that happened in Germany, you know, between the wars, and how doomed it was, and how all the infighting on the left made it possible for Hitler to rise to power, because everybody on the left was so busy undercutting each other,
right,
that they just fucking dropped the ball, like they missed it, and they were unable to like deliver for people who were hungry for some kind of immediate result, who were desperate because the currency was so, you know, people were like going down the street with wheelbarrows full of marks, you know, to buy a loaf of bread because the currency was in the fucking toilet.
Right.
But I think about that and I'm just like, we have a recent historical example in our own country, right? Like not in our own country, sorry, but we have a recent historical example that's like, can we not learn from this?
No.
Do we not, you know, but it's such a weird world right now.
But people use the same example. People use the same example and then selectively learn from it. For either, I would argue, either totally evil,
right?
You know, means or ends, I should say. Or people are like, yeah, we have to learn. We shouldn't do that again. Didn't we learn from this?
Well, no,
Why are we still talking? Yeah.
Right now, it's so much like, I'm not a fascist. You're a fascist.
Yes.
You know, like,
it's like three-year-olds yeah. fighting all the time. I know you are, but what am I, basically? Yeah.
Yeah.
It is really fascinating to hear you delve into, and again, I hope I'm not misconstruing anything, but that's what I'm picking up on, is someone just trying to negotiate what meaning means, what facts actually mean, but not in an overtly political way. Like, I just think there's a historical undercurrent to these songs that you're trying to reckon with and wondering why we're not all dealing, like processing things the same way. If that makes
any sense. Well, you're gonna make me weep, honestly, because I feel like you really listened to the record, because it's definitely true. So yeah. I really appreciate that a lot.
Well, I don't,
because it's also, you know, there's an aspect. I mean, I'm like super self lacerating. Like, I'm the first person to beat up on myself, and so I am to some degree self conscious about the idea that I wrote, you know, a politically motivated, the fact that I wrote a song, you know, fuck it. I wrote a song about January 6th I wrote a song about my reaction to a time of history that can have an event like January 6th and a public figure like Donald Trump and a world seemingly full of people who are just running to do everything counter to their own interests and our collective interests.
Yeah.
And like all those things, it's just like, but I take it very personally.
Yes.
Like, I think, you know, it's, I kind of feel like you sort of got it. You really got it. 'Cause it is about worrying about the future and just wanting to live, you know, just wanting to have, you know, for better or worse, like, we, our generation, it's like, Ricky Gervais said in that terrible, that thing that he just put out, but he said this one thing about, like, you know, we were in the sweet spot. Like, our generation grew up in a sweet spot of prosperity and ease and convenience, such that we just figured that was how the world is, you know?
Yeah.
And then you sort of learn that it's not that way, but that's quite different than the experience of people who actually do have to cope with fucking insane hardship, which is the majority of human history on the fucking planet.
Right.
So I always think about that too, because I'm like, well, you know, even like we saw this Kandinsky show in New York, and I was reading about Kandinsky, and it's all about like, well, he grew up in Russia, but then, you know, he had to leave because the Russian Revolution happened, but then he ended up in Germany, but then, oops, Germany in the 30s. Well, gotta go. Let's go to France. Oh, the Germans invade France. Like everywhere he went, you know, and like, so the Russians like seized all his property. So he's living in poverty, buffeted by the forces of history, but he still makes this incredible art that is, you know, so it's like, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think about all this kind of shit all the time.
I think if we're privileged enough to be able to speak out and express ourselves, we have to. So I don't think you should feel self-conscious about writing a song about a very significant happening in your particular country and how it relates to history, because not talking about it is what some of the people behind it want people to do. Stop talking about it.
Yeah.
You know, stop pointing out a thing that's just clear as day and we'll just deny it happened. So it's a very frustrating and complicated time for this kind of, it's not even dialogue anymore. It's just so clearly not that. So I just want to say you've provoked people like me to think about it from more of a historical point of view. And I think that's really valuable, because I do think this ahistoricism or decontextualization of events is really what's going to undo us all, because no one's on the same page with a knowledge base. We're all very fractured in our information consumption. So I think the more people who speak out in different mediums, the better. Although, again, that might be the reason why we're not on the same page. It's very confusing. It's very confusing. But all this to say, in the realm of art, I really appreciate this album. And before we wrap up, you invoked Jawbox, and I think I thought I saw that there was relatively recent activity for that band as well. But is there a status update on Jawbox, or are you fully immersed in being yourself?
Well, I mean, for me, creatively, I am fully immersed in being myself. I think, that, you know, Jawbox, we did a sort of a prolonged reunion, started in 2019.
Yeah.
And then it got whacked on the head for a couple of years because of COVID. And then we came back with a member change because Bill Barbeau, he moved to Vermont. He was like, what we did in 2019 was great. That's enough for me. I'm going to stay with my family in Vermont and not sort of try and ramp up the whole machine. So Brooks Harlan joined on guitar, which is phenomenal. I mean, I really couldn't imagine anyone else doing it, because he's such a great collaborator and friend and teammate, you know. So we played some more, and we made a couple stabs at writing some things, you know. But Jawbox really has to create collaboratively. So like, Jawbox is not a venue in which I will be able to be the songwriter,
right,
you know, anymore. And being the songwriter is something I really want to do.
Right.
So I need to at least know the arc, you know, that's part of creating the thing. So, I mean, it's not impossible. Like, I like the stuff we jammed and recorded some practices, and we came up with some pretty cool ideas. But as far as like, is that going to turn into a song? It was very hard to know who's going to, it just was very, the dynamic was, the sort of mechanics of it became difficult to judge. And then there's a big practical problem that, you know, Zach Barocas, who's a very strong personality musically and just as a person, like, basically in order to write a new Jawbox record, we all need to be in the same place for a prolonged period of time and really drill down. And so it's not impossible that we would do it, but it's pretty daunting. And I think it's also a little scary to imagine how it might turn out, because it would be significantly different sounding from the band that we were when we were initially, you know, when we wrapped up in the 90s. So
no, and that's fine. I just asked because I was, even in my research, was like, oh, I didn't even realize they reconvened that recently.
Yeah,
but
it was so fun. We did some really great shows, and we're supposed to play in October. We have a couple things that might happen. So it's not, you know, there's no, it's not acrimonious, and it's not like we don't want to have the band, but it's more of that. It's back to that growing older sort of, you know, thing where I'm like, if Jawbox is a band where I can't bring songs, fully formed songs, and sort of flesh out the last bits of it with people, but where instead the whole process has to happen from the ground up collaboratively. Well, for better or worse, I have lots of songs and I really want to play them. I want to finish them and play them and then sing them to people. So, so that's sort of where I want to put my energy, you know?
That makes sense. And speaking of which, like, we are talking about a record that's done. Have you been writing since you wrapped up making this album?
Only a very little bit. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's sitting on a hard drive. Like, there's songs that were recorded for this record that I really love that I think are super good. I'm really proud of them, but they didn't fit in the flow of the record. They would have sort of skewed the record too much one way or another. So I thought, oh, well, that's cool. I'll save them for a future EP. Like, it's like I have a head start on the next thing. So, but I haven't had a chance to do a whole lot of writing, but I'm trying to make sure that I get back to that. Mostly like it's like lyric fragment writing now, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's cool. I'm happy for you. You sound like you're in a good and motivated and inspired creative place. So that's excellent. And you are planning to go on the road with this album, I understand. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's 10 days in February that are sort of East Coast and Midwest dates, and working on some other stuff throughout the year. There's no real, I couldn't really imagine doing a long tour like I used to do. I mean, I don't know how your experience of that was from your youth, like, but I mean, I remember in the 90s, you know, everybody I knew was like, oh, we're going out for 6 weeks and then we come home for a week and we're going to Europe for 8 weeks, you know?
Yeah.
And then guess what? We are going to come home and break up the band because we can't fucking take it.
Yeah. But I didn't have that personally. I didn't get to do it as much, but certainly road managing bands for 3 weeks at a time. You're like, man, this is a lot. And you get back. Yeah, no, I understand. It's a different landscape for that too. It's hard to even get shows because of all the demand for venues and venues shutting down. So I think you're right to do a 10-day tour. That sounds reasonable. And
that's about as long as I would want to do. And it's, you know, it's a shame because it is great if you play every day and you kind of get the songs, everything's become second nature and it feels really good. But I also want to be home and be with my wife and, you know, operate my studio and record other people's music because I just love that. That's so nourishing for me, that experience, you know? So I feel really fortunate that I have a lot of good things to try to balance, you know?
Yeah. No, it's good. And again, the record's out on Discord and people can click on the links and stuff that I put in the show notes to learn more about that. Jay, if we can go out on a song from Basilisk, I wonder if you can choose one for us and maybe say why. Oh, actually, before I get to that, sorry, do you want people to follow you on things? I always ask that and I forgot. Websites or social media, that kind of thing?
Sure, why not? That would be wonderful. what can I say? I mean, I have two Instagram handles in an effort to separate my studio life from my music creating life, but I'm so half-assed in Instagram that they sort of mush together.
Right.
So one of them is Jay Robbins Official. That's me singing and playing. And the other one is Magpie Cage, which is the name of my studio.
Okay.
So that's me on Instagram. And then I think I put a link tree there that has all the other stuff, like the studio website. And, you know, I'm going to try and get together another actual... There's a jrobbins.net right now, but it's a Tumblr page. So that's how lame I am. It's really like... I'm going to try and get that into the 21st century.
Yeah, there's so many hours. There's only so many hours in every day. Despite all the urgency we're talking about, it's hard to get to everything. So don't fret about that. Okay. Yeah. So your Instagram and your Linktree, and like I say, I'll link to those as well. So people can just click on those. Now, as I was starting to say, and I interrupted myself, if there's a song we can go out on from the new album, can you choose one for us and tell us why it came to mind?
Oh my God. Do I have to choose one?
Yeah, that's the rule. I don't choose because I find asking the guest to choose provides even further insight as to where their head is at.
Oh, interesting. Well, I would probably pick Dead Eyed God, which is the last song on the record.
Okay. And why did that come to mind?
It might be my favorite song I ever wrote.
Hmm.
It's an outlier on the record. I mean, it's not like anything else on the record for sure, but it's a sort of a world that I hope to explore more sonically. And I feel like it's another lyric that's, you know, it has a similar sort of kernel of inspiration to Last War. But I think that, I don't know, that lyric just kind of came out of me. I didn't have to work very hard to write the lyric in that song, and I'm really proud of it. And I feel like, I don't know. I'm
there's some great lyrics on here.
I love that song.
Yeah, you should. So. There's some great lines here. Unfortunately, I believe it's inspired by one of the worst people in the history of all time. But some of these lines here really, alabaster idol, violence and fear define you, so white and cold, a mold to remake you in the image of a dead-eyed god. Like, it's very evocative and cuts to the core of these damaged people. You know, on some level, there's empathy in this song. It's not just anger, you know.
I'm really glad that you said that, because that's exactly what I was thinking. And I just didn't have the word, you know. It's not trying to be a finger pointing song. It's like a, yeah, I don't know.
Boys, so proud to make the most of your abusive father's ghost. It's right there. That notion of like, oh, where do these people come from? Oh, they come from pain. That manifests itself in anger and embitteredness and making, sorry, as a parent, you discover this too. Oh, you're picking on your sister because you feel picked on. And it's just a little microcosm of how the world works. Of like, oh, you're not feeling empowered, so you're going to make someone else feel less power. That's how it works. And you try to identify that as a parent. And usually I feel lucky. They're like, oh, yeah, I know what I'm doing now. We've been through this. I know why I'm acting this way. I better chill out. This seems to need to happen across the world. Of like, why are you acting this way? Oh, you're upset about something. You're mad at yourself, or you're upset with your own circumstance, and you're lashing out at everyone else to make them feel the sadness you feel. And that seems to be, sorry for pontificating, but that's what I read into that song.
No, you're like, that's very, it's very well, very well said. Okay. My wife works in she's a assistant in a kindergarten, and there are times that, you know, she'll like have a story from the day, right? And we'll just both be like, yeah, that's current events.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 They all inform each other. Okay, so let's hear it now. This is a bit of an anomaly on this beautiful album, but I'm happy to share. This is Dead-Eyed God by Jay Robbins. Jay, thank you so much for this time. It was so nice to encounter you. I hope you enjoyed this, and I also hope we speak again. Best of luck in the future.
Thanks so much, Vish. I really appreciate it. It's been great. Thank you.
boys so proud to make the most of your abusive father's ghost. Dreams of knife fight sacrifice to feed the dead-eyed god who populates ex nihilo this night.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Very nice to have Jay Robbins on the show. You know, one thing I neglected to ask him about is a record that meant a lot to me that he produced, Nothing Feels Good by The Promise Ring. That was a big record for some of my friends and I because The Promise Ring played in Guelph, Ontario. They even stayed at... was I living at the house at the time? I lived in a house that was like a punk rock house and The Promise Ring stayed there. Anyway, Jay Robbins produced that record, among others, and yeah, I didn't even think to ask him about it. It wasn't really germane. Anyway... Hope you enjoyed that chat with Jay Robbins. And in this case, he appeared on the 835th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available pretty much wherever you get your podcast. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about and you're looking for it, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit vishkana.com. You can follow or like my pages on social media. There's a link there, a link tree, and you can click on that, and then you can find me on the various things. I have to update it still, but, you know, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, Threads, those sorts of things. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. $6 or more a month grants you access to exclusive content, some audio archive stuff that I present there. You also get episodes earlier than everybody else. And if you like, you can receive a Creative Control t-shirt for your generosity. Just message me on Patreon. A note that if you join the $10 a month tier, you are eligible for entry in our monthly prize packs. And in this episode, there's a link to our January 2024 prize pack, which is courtesy of Beggars Group Canada. And it features records by the likes of Yola Tango, The Breeders, M. Du Mokhtar, Fucked Up, Kurt Vile, and Water From Your Eyes. You will also receive a copy of Mark Masters' excellent book, High Bias, The Distorted History of the Cassette Tape. So that is all if you enter a draw. And the way to enter the draw, the random draw, is to be a $10 a month or more member on the Patreon. So please, go to Patreon and join. Maybe you'll win. Also want to thank Blackbird Music, an independent record store in Alberta with stores in Edmonton and Calgary. And you can order stuff from their website, blackbird.ca. Also want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks, as always, to Jim Guthrie. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Jay Robbins and subscribing to this podcast or following it and checking out Basilisk by Jay Robbins, which is out on Discord Records. I will talk to you very soon. I hope you're well. Bye for now.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.